hoping for healthy outcomes for mother and child, so they're asked not to include those. Women typically write things like vaginal delivery, no epidural, no inducements, no episiotomy, family arrives on time, no forceps, latches to breast immediately, formula feed, and nice nurses. Their cards describe the picture that they've painted in their minds about their labor and delivery. When they're finished, and proudly gazing at their cards, they're asked to flip the cards over so they can't see what's on them, shuffle them, and pick 5 from the 10. At this point, they're told that these 5 work out, and the other 5 do not. Then they're asked, "Do you feel prepared if 5 out of 10 happen, rather than 10 out of 10? I think this is a very profound exercise, and not just for labor and delivery. We should expand the exercise to the life shuffle. When we develop expectations in our minds that have our entire self-worth riding on their realization, we set ourselves up for shame. Using the life shuffle to acknowledge our vulnerabilities and fears is a powerful way to reality check some of these expectations. The magnification principle. The life shuffle can help us better understand how much emotion we've attached to specific expectations. But if we're going to address expectations and the fear of vulnerability, we have to talk about how most women are socialized to believe that certain life events are lifesavers. No matter how bad things are, if we find a boyfriend, things will be better. If we get married, they'll be even better. If we have children, they'll be so much better we won't be able to stand it. Through the research process, I have come to believe that whatever problems you take into a life event will become instantly magnified the moment the hoopla surrounding that life event comes to a close. If you're single and struggling with identity issues, finding a partner will magnify your issues. Again, the magnification may not show up until the shine of new love is over, but it will show up. Whatever problems you and your partner take into a marriage get magnified. The same thing applies to having children. Not only are the issues staying, they are going to get more complicated and complex. If your parents' approval is very important to you, having a child will not change that. You'll just have many more items to submit for approval. I interviewed a woman in her late 50s who told me that she married her physically abusive boyfriend despite warnings from her friends and family. At the time, she believed his promises to work on his anger once they got married. After the birth of her first son, her husband became more violent. She felt totally isolated. She said, "I didn't listen to anyone. I really believed getting married or having kids would change him. It was so bad. But there was no way I could go to my parents or friends. They warned me. I stayed until he broke my nose and my arm. I couldn't hide that from my family." Change can happen, and there's always the potential for growth. However, a life event will not provide the change or growth we're seeking. If we get married, the jealous partner becomes more fearful because the stakes are higher. The mother who expects us to do everything perfectly has even higher expectations because the stakes are higher. Strained sibling relationships become even more strained in the face of family caretaking challenges. In this way, the magnification principle serves as a catalyst for exposing the failed expectations tied to a major life event. When we have our self-worth riding on the realization of something that we can't control, we put our self-worth in jeopardy. When we say, "This relationship will get better, we just need to get married," and things get worse after you get married, that can become a tremendous source of shame. Again, if we are going to recognize and accept what makes us human, including our imperfections and less than extraordinary lives, we must embrace our fears and vulnerabilities. Understanding our fear is part of the shame resilience process. It's also an important piece in building the kind of relationships that we need to have full and connected lives. 8. Practicing compassion in a culture of blame. "This is your fault. This is all my fault. You're to blame. I'm to blame." We are a culture obsessed with finding fault and assigning blame. Holding ourselves or others accountable is a good thing, but blame and accountability are very different. I think the difference between accountability and blame is very similar to the relationship between guilt and shame. Like guilt, accountability is most often motivated by the desire to repair and renew. It is holding someone responsible for his actions and the consequences of his actions. On the other hand, we often use blame to discharge overwhelming feelings of fear and shame. This is painful. Who can I blame? I'll blame you. You are bad, and this is your fault. Inherent in holding ourselves or others accountable for our behavior is expecting change or resolution. Like shame, blame shuts us down and is not an effective tool for change. If I experience shame because I lose my patience with my child, and I blame myself for being a bad mother, I'm more likely to get pulled even further into my shame. If, on the other hand, I lose my patience with my child, experience shame, then hold myself accountable for my behavior, I'm more likely to apologize to my child and figure out how to move through the shame so I can be the parent I want to be. The same ideas apply to blaming others. Maggie, a mother in her 20s, told me that one of her worst shame experiences happened when her 6-year-old son fell off their trampoline and broke his wrist. When her best friend, Dana, arrived at the emergency room, Maggie fell apart and started crying. She told Dana, "I feel like such a horrible mother. I can't believe Matthew broke his little wrist. I should have been watching him more closely." Dana replied, "No, you should have bought that fence I told you about. I told you something like this would happen." Maggie sank deeper into shame. Dana didn't feel the need to practice compassion with Maggie because she blamed Maggie for her son's injury. The blame I'm talking about in Maggie and Dana's story is very overt, but this is not always the case. Often blame is subtle and insidious. We don't even know that we're doing it, or why we're doing it. For example, if we're driving down the street and get a flat tire, we wind up berating ourselves because we're fat and ugly. We convince ourselves that flat tires don't happen to thin, beautiful women, just bad people like us. Or we bounce a check and all of a sudden, rather than thinking, "I need to watch that account a little closer," we're thinking, "I'm stupid. This happened because I never finished college." The culture of blame permeates our lives. We are constantly blaming and shaming ourselves and others. In earlier chapters, we talked about separating and insulating. Both of these are byproducts of a blaming culture. In this chapter, we'll explore 4 more concepts related to blame: anger, invisibility, stereotypes and labeling, and exclusion. I'll also discuss how women use the 4 elements of shame resilience to move from blame to compassion. Anger. The emotion that underlies our obsession with blaming and finding fault is anger. In our shame and blame culture, visible anger is everywhere. Political talk shows have become screaming matches. A short drive to the grocery store becomes an obstacle course of raging, finger-flipping drivers. Angry public outbursts directed at strangers and customer service people are becoming more commonplace. Anger can be motivated by many different experiences and feelings. Shame, humiliation, stress, anxiety, fear, and grief are several of the most common triggers. The relationship between shame and anger is about using blame and anger to protect us from the pain caused by shame. Shame researchers June Tangney and Rhonda Deering explain that one strategy for protecting ourselves during a shaming experience is to turn the tables and shift blame outward. In their research, they found that when we blame others, we often experience self-righteous anger. Because anger is an emotion of potency and authority, being angry can help us regain a sense of control. Regaining control is important because shame leaves us feeling worthless, paralyzed, and ineffective. The shame, blame, anger response, described by Tangney and Deering, is very similar to moving against, the strategy of disconnection we talked about in Chapter 3. Moving against is the strategy of trying to gain power over others, being aggressive, and using shame to fight shame. I interviewed many women who talked about using anger and blame to cope with their overwhelming feelings of shame. What I heard from these women was a profound sense of regret and sadness about their misuse of anger. Turning to rage and anger as a solution for shame only increases our sense of feeling flawed and unworthy of connection. Tangney and Deering write, "It almost goes without saying that such shame-based anger can pose serious problems for our interpersonal relationships. The recipients of shame-motivated anger are apt to experience such anger as erupting out of the blue. Feeling that it makes little rational sense, the hapless observer is often left wondering, where did that come from?" Tangney and Deering go on to say, "Thus, although defensive anger may represent a short-term gain in lessening the pain of shame in the moment, on balance, this sort of shame-blame sequence is likely to be destructive for interpersonal relationships, both in the moment and in the long run. Defensive shame-based blame and anger may subsequently lead either to withdrawal by either party or both parties, or to escalating antagonism, blame and counterblame. In either case, the end result is likely to be a rift in the interpersonal relationship. Anger is not a bad emotion. In fact, feeling anger and appropriately expressing anger are vital to relationship building. Lashing out at others when we are in shame is about feeling anger. When we are doing this, we feel shame and mask it with anger. Furthermore, shame-motivated anger and blame are rarely expressed in a constructive way. Shame floods us with emotion and pain, and the shame, blame, anger instinct is to pour it all over someone else. If one of our primary shame screens is anger and blame, it is essential that we understand and acknowledge this coping strategy. Next, we need to find out how, when we recognize that we are in shame, to calm down and stay mindful. Many of the women I spoke with talked about the value of deep breathing. I know that staying quiet and taking deep breaths helps me get back on my emotional feet when I feel shame. Some women talked about excusing themselves from situations and literally walking away. We all need to find out how to get the time out we need to feel our way through the shame so we make conscious decisions about our reactions and responses. In my research and in my personal life, I've found this takes a lot of practice. It also takes the courage to go back and to make amends when our anger, blame, responses get the best of us. Invisibility. Using anger and blame as protection from shame makes sense when you think about shame as being exposed. For many of us, shame is about exposure, or the fear of exposure. This is why we work so hard to hide the flawed parts of ourselves that leave us open to being ridiculed or judged. Our fear of being put down keeps us from speaking out. Our need to look or act perfect keeps us at home, under the covers. But in addition to feeling shame about what we see in ourselves or what others see, we can also feel shame about what we don't see. This other side of shame is sometimes more difficult to identify and name. It's the shame of invisibility. For several years, I taught a graduate social work course on women's issues. During each semester, I would dedicate one class to Magazine Day. Students would bring copies of their favorite fashion magazines to class. We'd always end up with at least 150 diverse magazines spread across the floor. I'd give the students scissors, glue, and construction paper. Their first assignment was to spend 1 hour flipping through the magazines and cutting out images to make a collage of their ideal looks. The clothes, jewelry, hair, makeup, arms, legs, feet, shoes, etc. that inspired them. By the end of that first hour of class, each student would have a completed collage, many of them very detailed. One of the most significant consciousness-raising issues that emerged from this exercise is how quickly we cut women up to piece together our ideal images. We want her eyes, her nose, these lips, this hair, but in this color. Her arms are too skinny, but I like her thighs. We basically dismember women to carve out perfection. Their next assignment was to find and cut out images from the magazines that actually looked like them. Pictures that closely represented the way they really look, their actual body size and shape, arms, legs, butts, what they were wearing that day, their hair, etc. After about 15 minutes, students often became frustrated and stopped searching. When they held up these collages, some had a pair of shoes or a similar hairstyle, but that was it. I asked the class one simple question in relation to this exercise. Where are you? You pay for this magazine. You love it. Where are you? The answer is simple, yet potentially shaming. We're not there because we don't matter in that culture. And the further you get away from the ideal, young, beautiful, white, fine features, sexual, thin and looking childlike, wealthy, seductive, needing to be rescued, confused, in danger, the less you matter. The last step in the magazine exercise is answering the question, how does being invisible make you feel? The vast majority of the women told me that they immediately felt self-blame. I'm invisible because I'm not good enough, or I'm invisible because I don't matter. It was not until we started talking about the critical awareness questions that women realized that blaming themselves was shaming and destructive. Invisibility is about disconnection and powerlessness. When we don't see ourselves reflected back in our culture, we feel reduced to something so small and insignificant that we're easily erased from the world of important things. Both the process of being reduced and the final product of that process, invisibility, can be incredibly shaming. In the interviews that focused on aging, trauma issues, and stereotyping, there was a strong connection to this issue of invisibility. This was also true for participants who spoke about identity issues like race and sexual orientation. In sharing their experiences and insights with me, the research participants helped me discover the primary mechanism used to reduce and erase us, stereotypes. Stereotypes and labels. Even though we all use stereotypes every day, I think starting with a definition is helpful. Here's the clearest one I have found. A stereotype is an overgeneralized and rigid definition of group characteristics that is assigned to people based on their membership in a group. Sometimes we feel okay about using stereotypes because we're not using them to be malicious or enforce prejudice. We're just using them to give someone a quick picture. She won't do it. She's really granola. I'm not sure what she'll think. She's pretty red state. Don't ask her. She's the total soccer mom. The ones I catch myself using most often are shoe-related. She wears clogs. She's more flip-flops than loafers. On the face, or foot of it, these seem pretty harmless. But it's a quick trip from benign to shaming. Take a look at these statements from the interviews. She's Chinese or something. You know, she's smart. She's Indian. They're super rude like that. She's so closed-minded. I can't stand old people. I think she's like that because she was raped a couple of years ago. It won't hurt her feelings. She's the real sweet grandma type. I don't think she's mad. She's just got that whole angry black thing going on. Her boyfriend is from Pakistan. She's probably not allowed to go out. These are not harmless. They are hurtful and shaming. And while we might wince when we hear them, most of us do this type of stereotyping on a regular basis. Stereotyping gives us a way to file people into predetermined categories that we understand and that make sense to us. It also gives us permission to blame people for their struggles, so we are excused from our responsibility to practice compassion. I don't need to sit with you in your pain. You brought it on yourself. Positive or negative, stereotypes hurt people, individually and collectively. According to researchers, positive stereotypes produce sanitized and idealized images, while negative stereotypes produce demeaning and ridiculing portraits. Either way, we've reduced you to something we can fit in our mental drawer. Here's what Michelle Hunt, an organizational development and diversity expert, writes about stereotyping. I don't want to be categorized. I can't afford it. I have spent my whole life building up who I am with all my multidimensions and complexities, and I get offended when I'm put into a category as, for example, a feminist or an African American. It's saying that I walk, talk, and think like one whole group of people. That's the danger of some of the ways in which diversity is addressed today. The discussion threatens to increase categorization, not diminish it. At the same time, my uniqueness, which includes being a woman and an African American and everything else I am, is what I want to have valued. I need to be allowed to bring my uniqueness to the table. When women spoke about being stereotyped and feeling invisible, I heard two different issues emerge. I call the first one whispered labels. I named it this because that's how the participants described them. Quiet whisperings behind their backs. Pieces of their lives used to label who or what they are. For example, she's just a mom. She's a cancer survivor. She was abused growing up. She's bipolar. She's a recovering alcoholic. Her husband committed suicide. She's old and senile. She's a feminist. Her husband beats her. She lives in a trailer. She's an only child. She's on welfare. She's a lesbian. She's Mexican. She was raped a couple of years ago. If you say, she's an only child. As a point of fact, that's not hurtful. However, if you say she's an only child as a way to explain why someone acts a certain way, she's really self-centered, you know, she's an only child, then it becomes a label. Likewise, if you describe someone's ethnicity by saying she's Mexican, that's great. If you use it to explain why someone is behaving a certain way or to set up expectations for a person, that's a hurtful stereotype. Stereotyping and labeling limit our ability to build connection. When we think we know someone because of her membership in a particular group, we build relationships on assumptions. We miss the opportunity to know others and to be known. For many women, labels are about engaging in a fixed fight against preconceived social community expectations and ultimately turning ourselves over to invisibility. Here's how one participant explained her experiences. The most difficult thing about people finding out I'm a lesbian is the assumptions they make. People automatically assume they know everything about me. Once they know you're gay, people think they can fill in the blanks for the rest of your life. They assume you've probably been abused by a man at some point in your life. They assume you hate men. They assume you're masculine and like sports. They expect you to act, dress, vote, and spend money a certain way. Most people outside the gay and lesbian community don't understand that there is as much diversity in our community as there is in the straight community. You never hear people saying, "Oh, you're straight, say no more, I know everything about you." Sexual orientation doesn't dictate your politics, your religion, your beliefs, your values, what you like, and who you are. I don't assume to know you when I find out you're straight. Don't assume to know me when you find out I'm a lesbian. The second issue related to stereotyping is name-calling, and it is almost always driven by social community stereotypes. Examples of name-calling include hurtful labels like slut, whore, trash, loudmouth, ballbuster, bitch, crazy, drama queen, neurotic, dyke, and pushy broad. When used as put-downs, terms like gay or queer are equally offensive. Many of these names are pre-manufactured and ready to apply the second women break from social community expectations. They are used so frequently that it is easy for us to forget how hurtful they can be. It is also easy to overlook the fact that name-calling is one of the most powerful ways to reinforce a stereotype. Using identities as insults demeans individuals and entire groups of people. Always the exception to the rule. If we're honest with ourselves, I think most of us would admit that we are very susceptible to relying on stereotyping, labeling, and name-calling. One mechanism that helps to keep stereotypes alive and strong is the exception factor. Many of us find ourselves supporting stereotypes for the population at large, yet dismissing the same stereotype when it doesn't fit with our personal experiences. We may make broad generalizations about feminists, but when someone challenges us by saying, "I'm a feminist and I'm not like that," we automatically grant her special immunity. We will say something like, "Oh, not you, I'm talking about the other feminists," or, "Come on, you're different." Here are some examples of how the exception factor really works against our efforts to build connection and resilience. I'm a 32-year-old mother of two. I'm very involved in the community, and I'm vice president of the neighborhood association. When I was in college, I was in a sorority, and I drank a lot. I realized after graduation that I had a problem, and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a recovering alcoholic with 8 years sobriety. People want so badly to believe that all alcoholics are old, smarmy, unscrupulous businessmen, but they always tell me what an odd alcoholic I am. Or they ask me questions like, "Are you sure you're an alcoholic?" When I explain that there are a lot of people in recovery that look just like me, they absolutely refuse to believe it. They think that making me the exception is a compliment when it's really shaming and hurtful. It's those kinds of uneducated, narrow-minded people that make talking about addiction so difficult. One day I was talking with my best friend about my boyfriend, Matt. Things were starting to get serious, and she was asking all about our relationship. My friend asked me if I was going to tell Matt that my father had sexually abused me. I told her that we had kind of talked about it, but I would probably tell him everything eventually. She freaked out. She told me, "You better not. It will change things." When I asked her what she meant, she warned me that he might not enjoy sex with me anymore. Or he might think that I will cheat on him, or worse, that he might not want to get married because he'll be scared I'll do it to my kids. I was shocked and totally hurt. I asked her if she thought being abused made me weird, promiscuous, or more likely to abuse my children. She said, "I don't think that about you necessarily, but probably it might be true of other people who've been abused." She'll never know how much that hurt me, or how much it changed my feelings for her. In schools of social work, we spend a considerable amount of time studying stereotyping and labeling. As I mentioned previously, we don't believe in the concept of pure objectivity. So, in order to maintain meaningful, ethical relationships with our clients, we have to explore our beliefs, values, and stereotypes. If we don't, we are likely to jump to conclusions about our clients, their problems, and our work. Over the years, I've realized how important it is for us to understand that we are not immune to applying stereotypes to ourselves and other people who share specific identities. The stereotypes that are among the most difficult to unearth and discuss are the ones that we believe we are allowed to express because they are aimed at our own group. Somehow we've come to believe that being a woman gives us permission to stereotype and label other women. Being a lesbian gives us the right to stereotype and label other lesbians, etc. About 5 years ago, I developed an exercise to help social workers identify these permitted stereotypes. To complete the exercise, I ask them to make a list of 3 identity groups to which they belong. Then I ask them to identify some of the stereotypes and labels associated with each identity group. Last, I ask them to identify stereotypes they use to characterize various members of their identity group. Our students are predominantly female, so most of the students identify women as a group that they belong to. When they identify stereotypes associated with women, they use labels like gossips, liars, backstabbers, manipulative, hysterical, and neurotic. Many of the students are quick to admit to using those terms to describe other women. This always sparks great conversation, because I normally respond by saying, "I don't think I am a gossip, a liar, or backstabber. I don't think I'm manipulative, or neurotic, or hysterical. I haven't experienced any of you in these ways. I'm curious if these are the terms we use to describe women, yet we are not any of these things. Who are we? Where are all these gossiping, backstabbing, lying, alliance-making, neurotic, crazy women? This is when people say, well, we're the exception. They also make the case that if they're in the group, they can use these labels to describe other group members. If I'm overweight, I'm allowed to call you a fat ass. If we share a racial or cultural identity, I'm allowed to use terms that people outside of this group can't use. I think giving ourselves permission to stereotype and label our own group members becomes a slippery shame slope. We often fail to realize that we abandon ourselves and other group members when we turn against our own groups. Aging. During a recent workshop, I asked if anyone wanted to share his or her experience of completing the shame trigger exercise. A woman raised her hand and said, I looked at these triggers and perceptions and realized that it's not getting older that hurts. It's the fact that I actually believe all the myths about myself, my abilities, and my body. I don't think my body has betrayed me. My stereotypes are betraying me. When it comes to aging, participants explained that the power of aging stereotypes is far more painful than the actual aging process. This is partly due to the fact that aging stereotypes pervade every aspect of American life. Marty Kaplan, media analyst and associate dean at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communication, states that advertisers and television programmers have no interest in men and women over 50. He explains, in fact, some programmers are positively 50-plus averse. If there are statistics that show you are watched by that demographic, it's like kryptonite to advertisers. These were Dr. Kaplan's comments during a segment on CBS Sunday Morning. The show was doing a story on the coveted 18 to 49 demographic, America's most valued marketing and advertising demographic. The segment also highlighted an AARP ad that reads, These days, doctors don't pronounce you dead, marketers do. Let's look at some of the negative aging stereotypes and corresponding traits found by researchers. Despondent, afraid, depressed, hopeless, lonely, neglected. Recluse, naive, quiet, timid. Shrew, curmudgeon. Bitter, complaining, demanding, inflexible, prejudiced, nosy, stubborn. Mildly impaired, dependent, fragile, slow-moving, tired. Severely impaired, feeble, inarticulate, incoherent, senile. Vulnerable, afraid, bored, emotionless, hypochondriacal, miserly, wary, victimized. Now let's look at four of the positive stereotypes that emerged from the same research. Golden Ager. Active, alert, capable, lively, sociable, healthy. Perfect grandparent. Fun-loving, grateful, happy, loving, wise. Small-town neighbor. Frugal, old-fashioned, tough. John Wayne conservative. Emotional, nostalgic, patriotic, religious. As we look at these, it's hard to deny the way they might ring true for some of the people we know. That's what makes stereotypes so dangerous. The stereotype fits so closely that we give ourselves permission to dismiss anything that deviates from that image. When we see the woman across the street as the perfect grandmother, we are less likely to notice her bruises or other signs that she's being battered. Moreover, she might become so committed to living up to that expectation that she would never tell us. When we need our John Wayne father to live up to his tough guy image, he may be too ashamed to share his fears or vulnerabilities with us. Or, as seen in this example from the interviews, we might buy into the stereotype that our Golden Ager grandmother is so happy that she doesn't mind being reduced to a source of entertainment. My children and my grandchildren will say things to me like, "Dance for us, Grandma, dance." Not because I used to be a wonderful dancer, but because they watch me and they laugh at me. Sometimes if I'm dancing around, they'll say, "Go, Grandma, go." It's hurtful. I feel shame because they enjoy laughing at me. They see me as an old person who is entertaining. I'm their grandmother, not a real woman with feelings, not a talented, interesting person. I'm ashamed that it bothers me so much. I know they love me very much. It's just that they can be very insensitive at times. Stereotyping is a form of blaming and reducing, two of the primary ingredients for creating shame. If we want to move from blame to connection and compassion, we must work to become mindful of how, when, and why we stereotype. Surviving trauma. As we learned in the previous chapter, many of the messages that drive shame are about perfection, but when it comes to surviving trauma, the stereotypes are based on imperfection. That stigma of being damaged or permanently wounded, and blame, or somehow being responsible for your trauma. When I spoke with women about surviving and healing from trauma, I learned that social community expectations and stereotypes around trauma force women to deal with two separate issues: surviving the event itself, and surviving the shame we heap upon them when we use stereotypes to question their experiences and define who they are as survivors. When I say questioning their experiences, this can range from using stereotypes about women to asking questions like, "Was it really that bad?" or "What were you doing with him?" Rather than listening and trying to understand, we invalidate and diminish their experiences. In addition to questioning, stereotypes are used to frame someone's identity after the trauma. Most of us have internalized very strong ideas about how people can or cannot survive traumas. I recently gave a lecture at a women's professional organization. During the book signing that followed, a woman brought four books to the table. As tears rolled down her face, she said, "One book is for me. The others are for my sister and her two daughters. My niece was raped at college several months ago." She took a deep breath and said, "She was a beautiful, smart girl. She had her whole life in front of her." At first it caught me off guard and I thought, "Oh my God, she was killed." Then I realized I was signing a book for her. Her aunt meant that she was beautiful and smart before she was raped. I seriously doubt that this woman, standing in front of me, crying in public about her niece, realized what she was saying, or how it could shame her niece. We are all vulnerable to making these kinds of assumptions or judgments. How many times have we heard or thought, "She'll never be the same," or "She's screwed up forever now"? We can also use the knowledge of someone's trauma to explain his or her behavior. Alicia's story is an excellent example. Alicia and Tom had been dating for almost 2 years when I interviewed her. She described their relationship as coming to a sad end. When I asked why, she said that several months earlier, she had confided in Tom that she had been physically abused by her mother and stepfather growing up, and that was why her grandmother had raised her. She said that Tom was very compassionate and supportive, but now every time she got angry or upset, Tom attributed it to the fact that she had been an abused child. Alicia explained that in Tom's eyes, this was her new identity and the basis for all of her behavior. She said he even went back to when we first started dating and said things like, "Oh, it makes so much sense now. That's why you hated that movie." Just a couple of days before the interview, Alicia said she came home from work and started crying. Her boss had given her a really hard time in front of one of her colleagues. Tom's response was, "You have such a hard time dealing with criticism at work because you were abused by your parents." Alicia explained to Tom that it was normal not to want to be criticized in front of her peers, and asked him, "Can't I be like everyone else?" Tom didn't get it, and she asked him to move out. Alicia said, I was abused growing up. It was shameful, and I couldn't do anything about it because I was a kid. I won't continue to be defined that way in my 30s. I have the right to be someone besides that kid. When women talk about the shame of being sexually abused or raped, they associate most of the shame with the pain of being defined by their trauma. The events are, of course, horrific and can have a lasting effect. But the social community reaction to their experience and the attendant loss of identity and the right to be normal is just as painful and often produces the more enduring shame. If she has a father who could do that to her, what does that mean about her? She'll never be the same. She's damaged. She'll never be whole after that. I don't see how she'll ever be a good, fill in the blank, mother, partner, vice president. There are times when our feelings, thoughts, and actions relate directly to our past or current struggles, but there are certainly times when they don't. The problem arises because at some point, most of us begin to believe the expectations about who we're supposed to be, what we're supposed to look like, what we're supposed to do, how much we're supposed to be, and how little we're supposed to be. We also develop a fear of rejecting those expectations. We constantly see evidence that if we do reject these expectations, we will experience very painful disconnections and rejection. So we internalize these expectations and they become an emotional prison. Shame stands guard. Exclusion. I think it is impossible to talk to women about shame and blame without hearing stories about the pain of not fitting in or of feeling excluded. Throughout the interviews, women talked about gossiping, excluding, and backstabbing as tremendous sources of shame. I hate working with other women. They're so petty and jealous. They take things so personally and all they do is talk bad about each other. On the outside, I'm just like everyone else in our neighborhood. On the inside, I'm struggling to keep a marriage together that's falling apart right in front of my very eyes. My kids have problems. Shame is what happens deep on the inside. And the worse it is on the inside, the harder you have to work to make it look good on the outside. Sometimes I wish we could just show our inside so it wouldn't be so hard. But trust me, I'd never do that because I know how women talk about each other. They're brutal. Shame is when I grab my child by the top of the arm, and my teeth are clenched, and pure rage is coming out of my eyes, and I'm getting ready to just lay into him, and I look up, and another mother is watching me. That's not the kind of mother I want to be. Sometimes I just feel so pushed to the edge, I can't help it. I feel so ashamed when other mothers catch me in those moments because I want to scream and yell to them, this is really not who I am. I'm really a good mother. I'm not like this all the time. You know they tell everyone you're a nutcase. What else do they have to talk about? I went to a party a couple of months ago, and a woman came up to me and asked me what I did for a living, and I told her I stay home with my three kids. Immediately, she got this kind of disappointed look on her face, like, oh, you poor thing, and said, oh, well, good for you, and walked away. About 20 minutes later, I saw her talking to another woman, and I thought to myself, I'm not interesting anymore. Nothing matters about my life anymore that doesn't have to do with my kids. I wanted to start screaming at the top of my lungs in the middle of this party. I used to be an engineer. I used to be someone, I swear. I promise, I used to be important like you. At work, the guys dangle this carrot in front of the women. You can hang out with them if you sell enough, if you work more, if you give up your family. On one hand, I desperately want to be in the boys' club. They have more fun, get better clients, make more money, and have more freedom. On the other hand, I hate them. I don't want to be like them or do what they do. I just want to enjoy the perks. And when it comes to the women in that group, they are even more disgusting than the men. They'll really treat you like shit. Before I got promoted, I had a lot of friends in my department. We even hung out after work and on the weekends. When I got promoted, I became the bitch that fucked her way to the top. I've never dated or slept with someone from work, and they know that. I don't know about men, but when they promote women, they need to move them to another department. I told one of the women in my son's playgroup that we spank with the belt. Within 1 week, every single person in that group asked me about it. They were shocked and disgusted. A couple of them told me it was child abuse. I was completely taken by surprise. They acted like I was a monster. They even felt sorry for my kids. Not one of them invited me back to their house for playgroup. They didn't even invite my son to birthday parties. While some people propose that parts of excluding behavior are genetically predetermined, I don't believe that is true. I don't believe women have a natural tendency to be mean, manipulative gossips. Nor do I believe that all women are naturally kind, nurturing caregivers. I don't think either one of these stereotypes fits. And I don't think subscribing to sweeping generalizations helps us to understand or change some of the behaviors that we would indeed like to change. As I read over the interviews and tried to get a handle on this issue of gossiping and exclusion, I started to see parallels between these behaviors and my daughter's experiences in elementary school. Not because women are infantile and immature in their behaviors, but because observing young children can teach us a lot about ourselves. Most young children are truly authentic. What you see is definitely what you get. They have yet to learn how to hide, filter, and manipulate their experiences to fit what others are expecting. Their motivations are out in the open, and studying these motivations can sometimes help us better understand our own motivations, those that are hidden under layers of pretending and protection. The major connection I see is between gossiping and bullying, two painful forms of exclusion. In many bullying situations, kids taunt kids, not out of hatred or meanness, but out of the need to belong. Of course, there are children who, for varying reasons, have serious problems and are lone bullies. But most bullying is done by groups of kids. When you talk to the individual child, he or she often admits to participating in the bullying, only as a way to maintain a connection and sense of belonging. This is also true of gang mentality. Hurting or excluding others is often a way members demonstrate their loyalty and increase group acceptance. I think these same dynamics often apply to us as adults when we are in group situations. It's hard to admit, but picking someone apart or judging her is frequently used as a tool to connect and gain acceptance with other women. Think about how easy it is to forge an instant connection by talking about someone or saying something cutting about a mutual acquaintance. It's almost a rite of passage among new friends. If you can't think of something to say, talk bad about someone. We might go along with the water cooler gossip not because we believe it, but because it is how we connect with the coworkers who are standing there with us. We huddle close together and share secret information. We form a cohesive jury and pass judgment together. And when we walk away from the cooler, we have a little bounce in our step as we think, "These are my friends. They like me, and I like them." Of course, as the day wears on, we might get that sinking feeling when we wonder, "Do they talk like that about me?" When the woman who we earlier tried and convicted walks over and says something friendly, or just asks a question about the project we're working on, we wonder if she knows. We try to imagine how she'd feel if she had any clue about what we had said. We feel bad for a second, then we push that feeling away. But for most of us, that bad feeling creeps back up. We get angry with ourselves. "Why did I do that? I hate it when I gossip like that." Now the bounce in our step is gone and we're on shaky ground. We've lost touch with our courage and compassion. We've also forged a slippery bond with our coworkers. We know what happens at the water cooler. We feel like we have two choices: join them in the gossip or risk being the next target. I'm often asked if gossiping is really a serious form of exclusion. Is it a shame issue or just something that makes us feel mildly guilty? I think there are several answers to this question. First, we have to clarify. There's the issue of doing the gossiping, and then there's the issue of being the target of gossip. I can't tell you if gossiping about people is shaming. That's a very personal issue. For many of the women I interviewed, gossiping was described as shaming because it was often motivated by their need to belong. It also moved them away from being compassionate people. For others, it was more of a guilt issue. These women described it as more of a habit that made them feel bad. I can feel shame or guilt about gossiping. It depends on why I'm doing it, what I'm saying, and how I'm feeling. Being the target of gossip, however, is usually very shaming and extremely painful. What people say behind our backs can mirror our list of unwanted identities. It's our greatest fear. We walk out of the room and people start using our most hated identities to describe us. This happened to one of the research participants. Let's look at her story. I met Lori through her best friend Melanie. Melanie participated in an early round of interviews, then again last year. During my second interview with Melanie, she suggested that I call Lori, who, as she explained, had experienced one of the worst shaming events you could imagine. Lori and I ended up connecting over the phone. Lori and Melanie had been friends since high school. Now in their 30s, they live in different states, but managed to stay connected through email and occasional visits. Lori lives in a large suburban neighborhood and has many friends. She works part-time for her husband's company and is very involved in neighborhood activities. Melanie described her as the kind of person who knows all the neighbors and everyone at her kids' schools. Both Lori and Melanie pointed out how Lori is very committed to being a good mother and parent. Every month, Lori and 8 other families in her neighborhood take turns hosting a family potluck dinner. Lori was at one of these potluck dinners with her family when this, hard to imagine, shame story unfolded. Lori explained that she was in the kitchen with 5 or 6 other mothers. The men were outside, and the kids were playing in the den and the bedrooms. Lori said, "My youngest daughter came in and told me that her sister, Callie, didn't eat any of her pizza but was eating her second cupcake. I got frustrated and followed my daughter out of the kitchen to find Callie. I found her, talked to her about skipping dinner, and was heading back into the kitchen when I stopped to scoop up a bunch of cupcake crumbs on the floor right outside the kitchen." Lori continued describing the scene. "As I'm cleaning up the floor, I hear my friends whispering. One said, 'She's so hard on those girls.' Another agreed, 'Yeah, she gets so mad when they don't eat, but look at her, she's skin and bones. What does she expect?' Another friend said, 'I know, she's such a perfectionist. Do you think she's anorexic?'" Lori explained that it didn't even cross her mind that they could have been talking about her. But when she walked into the kitchen, it became clear right away, just from the looks on their faces, that Lori was the subject of these comments. Lori told me, "I just stood there with my mouth open. I didn't know if I should scream and run out of the house or just start crying." She said, finally, one of the women said, "I'm so sorry, Lori, we were just talking." Another jumped in and said, "Really, we're sorry. We just get worried a little. You know we love you to death." Lori said she just looked at them and said, "It's okay, I need to go." Lori gathered up her kids and her husband and went straight home. Lori didn't leave the house all weekend. Sheila, one of the women in that kitchen, left 2 messages asking Lori to call her. Lori didn't return the calls. On Monday morning, she had her husband drop the kids off at school. Early Monday afternoon, 3 of the women came to her house. She reluctantly opened the door but didn't invite them into the house. They stood on her porch and apologized. Lori said, "They were sorry that I overheard them and that it hurt my feelings, but they didn't apologize for what they said." About 2 weeks later, Lori finally told Melanie what had happened. Lori said, It was even shaming to tell her about it. It's degrading for Melanie to know. My friends think that of me. Lori told her about the three women coming to apologize, and that one woman had left 5 messages on her answering machine. Melanie listened and offered her support. Melanie also suggested that Lori return Sheila's calls. A couple of days later, Sheila called again, and Lori, checking the caller ID, decided to answer. Sheila was profoundly sorry. She apologized for not speaking up and putting the gossiping to an end. She told Lori, We are your friends. We should either tell you that we are worried about your health, or we shouldn't say anything at all. We definitely shouldn't talk behind your back. I'm so sorry I didn't say anything when they were doing it, or when you walked in. Lori and Sheila talked for an hour. Lori said, I was crying. I just kept asking her how I could face everyone and act normal again. Lori also asked Sheila why she hadn't come with the group of women, or left an apology on the answering machine. Sheila explained that she needed to do this by herself. She told Lori, Trying to fit in with this group is what got me into this nightmare in the first place. Sheila also told Lori, I didn't say anything on the recorder because I didn't know if you had told your husband or not. I'd probably be too embarrassed to tell anyone. Both of these answers made Lori feel better. Sheila was being honest. It stung a bit when she told Lori why she hadn't apologized on the answering machine. But it also made Lori believe that Sheila understood how shaming this experience was for her. Sheila and Lori decided that they would go together to pick up the kids, and that Sheila would help Lori ease back into the group. Sheila also volunteered to call a meeting of the friends if Lori wanted to discuss it. Lori didn't want to do that. Lori told me, Things are about as back to normal as I think they can be. I don't know if it will ever be the same. Sheila and I are much closer, but the group seems to be split a little more. I for sure will not be the same. That was a moment of shattering pain for me. I never knew gossiping and talking about people could be so damaging. If there is any question about how hurtful or shaming gossiping can be, this story should provide a good answer. Most of us can't bear to consider what might be said about us by a gossiping group of neighbors. Resilience and exclusion. The greatest challenge for many of us is finding a way out of the excluding and gossiping when it's actually happening. If we are with friends or colleagues who start talking bad about or ganging up on someone, how do we decline to participate? Again, this is a difficult situation because our connection is in danger. For a couple of years, I experimented with various techniques for staying connected to women without relying on exclusion and competition as the catalysts for connection. I found that some techniques are very effective and others leave you very vulnerable to attack. Often we use the default technique of moving the target from one person to another. Unfortunately, this technique still leaves someone with a bullseye on her back. For example, suppose someone says, She's such a bitch, I can't believe she got promoted. Who do you think she slept with to get that? We might try to shame the shamer. I can't believe you are buying into that idea that women who succeed are bitches that sleep their way to the top. That is such a demeaning stereotype. You are just feeding it and making us all look bad. When I first came into my critical awareness, I felt the need to publicly hold people accountable for their shaming. I soon realized that it's not a good idea to back people into a corner. Even making a valid point doesn't warrant using shame or intentionally putting someone on the spot in front of other people. Next, I tried the teach-preach approach. Although it's a little less drastic than shaming, it doesn't work well either. In this example, we might respond to the shame comment by saying, I'm not going to talk badly about her. It hurts all women. We need to support one another. But when we teach-preach, we are likely to find the target stuck to our backsides as we swagger away from the group. I've come to the point in my life where I often express my feelings about statements I perceive as hurtful and or hateful. But for me, that's best accomplished by talking with someone one-on-one and focusing on how a comment or discussion made me feel. When I'm in the gang-think situation, I've found two techniques that work without relying on moving the target. Reflecting and or redirecting are very effective ways to not participate and provoke